Carlo, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is the February 21st, 2019 afternoon session of the Portland City Council. Carlo, please call the roll.
Fritz? Fish?
Here.
Hardesty?
You gotta say here. Say here.
Here.
Thank you. Sorry. You, Daly?
Here.
Wheeler?
Boy, this is starting early. Here. Good afternoon.
Somebody's happy to see me, Mayor.
It's good to see you.
Yeah.
It is good to see you.
Welcome to the Portland City Council. The City Council represents all Portlanders and meets to do the city's business. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during City Council meetings so everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, and respected and safe. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. If it does not, you may be ruled out of order. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When you have 30 seconds left, a yellow light goes on. When your time is done, a red light goes on. If you are in the audience and would like to show your support for something that is said, please feel free to do a thumbs up. If you want to express that you do not support something, please feel free to do a thumbs down. Please remain seated in council chambers unless entering or exiting. If you are filming the proceedings, please do not use bright lights or disrupt the meeting. Disruptive conduct, such as shouting or interrupting testimony or council deliberations, will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Thank you for helping your fellow Portlanders feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Thank you very much. Carly, could you please read the first item, item 158?
Extend the state of housing emergency, operational efficiencies, and identify council powers, specify a 24-month duration, and waive portions of the Portland Zoning Code.
Colleagues, steep rent increases, very low vacancy rates, and housing demand that far outpaces supply precipitated an affordable housing crisis in Portland. To address the tremendous suffering of unsheltered people and households on the brink of homelessness, the City Council declared a homelessness state of emergency back in 2015. We're still very much in this state of emergency and continue to work in multiple ways to mitigate emergency conditions. And today our presenters are going to walk us through these actions. Administratively, first of all, I want to note that Commissioner Udaly is here today, and we are more than happy to see her back with us today. Our thoughts have certainly been with you in the last several days, and we're glad to see you back. Her presence also gives us the opportunity to amend this to put the emergency clause back on, which I'd like to move.
So moved.
So we have a motion.
Second.
And a second. We'll make that a motion for Commissioner Hardesty and a second for Commissioner Fish. That is to restore the emergency clause on item 158. Please call the roll.
Do we have the language for that?
Do we need language for that? Legal counsel.
Yes, we need some language. Was there language on a pre-existing version of it?
Not that I have in my hand.
This wasn't an original emergency as submitted. I don't.
Oh, do you have something, Rebecca?
We usually have Commissioner Fritz.
I know the crowd.
So you can add emergency language from.
Thank you.
I mean, we just need to declare a reason why the emergency exists, and then we can say that it'll be in
The reason for the emergency clause, and just to be clear, the purpose of the clause is so that the ordinance takes effect immediately after passage as opposed to 30 days after the second reading, given that this is a very important issue, given that the passage of this ordinance immediately will allow us to continue the flexibility that's provided for the expedited permitting of affordable housing, that this gives us the flexibility we need in the community to site both emergency shelter and alternative shelter, and given that this allows us to continue to site storage lock, what do you call them?
Storage lockers
across the city of Portland. The city council therefore finds it's in the public interest to declare an emergency on item 158.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Not as good as Commissioner Fritz would have done, but passable. Please call the roll.
Fish.
Here. Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Here. Aye. The amendment's on the table. Colleagues, we will now hear from our panel, Shannon Callahan from the Portland Housing Bureau, Joe Zender from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and Rebecca Esau from the Bureau of Development Services, and Joshua Bates from the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Shannon Callahan of the Portland Housing Bureau. Our presentation this afternoon will provide an overview of the city's declarations regarding a housing emergency, actions the city and our partners have taken directly related to the declarations of emergency, as well as next steps related to this requested extension. In October of 2015, City Council first established a housing state of emergency. This declaration of emergency gave the city expanded authority, as the mayor has said, to site day storage units, expeditiously issue permits for shelter and alternative shelters, and in 2016 established an expedited design review process for new affordable housing developments. When the city first declared the emergency, we were experiencing some of the highest rent increases in the nation, coupled with an extremely low vacancy rate for housing, which unsurprisingly increased the number of people experiencing homelessness and needing shelter and permanent housing. In the intervening time, while rent growth has slowed and vacancy rates have increased, we have simultaneously doubled the number of people we are assisting with shelter and permanent housing, though the need in our community persists, and the need to continue the powers we were granted under the Declaration of Emergency continue. As a result of the emergency, the city has increased funding for housing and homelessness, created new policies and programs to help us solve the crisis. Since the time of the declaration, we have stepped up our investments in both housing and services. Last year, we opened 800 new units of permanently affordable housing, providing stable quality homes throughout our community for more than 1,800 people. And this year, we expect to open the doors to 1,000 more new units. Since the initial declaration, the city has adopted a comprehensive inclusionary zoning program, ensuring that new developments are part of the solution to the crisis, not contributing to the problem. By requiring all that new developments over 20 units include affordable housing. As a result, we already have over 362 units in process or in operation today. I'd now like to turn it over to Joshua Bates, who's joining us from the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
Thank you. Greeting Mayor and Council members. My name is Joshua Bates. I'm the new Equity Manager for the Joint Office of Homeless Services. I've actually been in the role for about 2 months now, so this is my first large public meeting. I'm here today on behalf of our Director, Mark Jolin, and our Deputy Director, Patricia Rojas, who are both unfortunately not able to attend and are out of town. The Joint Office of Homeless Services is very supportive of the proposal before you to extend the state of emergency for an additional 2 years. As Shannon pointed out, underneath the state of emergency, the city and the county have significantly increased investments in homeless services. And with these investments, we've been able to respond to the crisis in unprecedented ways. As tens of thousands of people have lost their homes, we've been able to respond by dramatically increasing our prevention, housing placement, and sheltering efforts. And I meant to say housing, as tens of thousands of people have lost their housing. As you can see here, since 2015, we've nearly doubled from just under 3,000 to nearly 6,000 people per year who we are helping escape homelessness through placement into permanent housing. During the same period of time, we've more than doubled from 4,000 to over 8,000 the number of people served in emergency shelter each year. And over the last 2 years, we've started to see real increases in the number of people we're able to help keep the housing they already are in through prevention investments. over 6,300 people last year, a more than 30% increase over 2016. These increases have allowed us to respond to the emergency, but they haven't ended it. We continue to have more than 2,000 highly vulnerable people on our waiting list for permanent supportive housing, and more than 1,300 families with children on the waiting list for help finding permanent housing, and shelter stays continue to grow, now averaging around 3 months. In addition to expanding investments in overall system capacity, the Joint Office of Homeless Services has used the state of emergency to expand the number of emergency shelters in our community at the fastest rate in decades. We have used the declaration of the state of emergency to help us open more than 650 new beds of year-round shelter for men, women, couples, families with children, veterans, and domestic violence survivors. We've distributed those shelters geographically, and we've removed the barriers that traditionally kept many of the most vulnerable people out of our shelters. We've also used the state of emergency to launch new alternative shelter, the Kenton Women's Village, to help relocate Right to Dream 2 and to begin the process of relocating Hazelnut Grove. That work has led to more than doubling the number of people who have access to shelter each year in our community, and it helped lead to a reduction in unsheltered homelessness and a reduction in unsheltered chronic homelessness between 2015 and 2017. That work has also led to national recognition for the transformation of how we provide shelter in our community. But our shelter system expansion and transformation is not complete. A number of shelters have not yet transitioned from temporary to permanent facilities. We are in the midst of creating new service-enriched shelters in East and downtown Portland. And importantly, we continue to work to stabilize our alternative shelters, to put them on sound footing, and create the possibility for the creation of additional community-led alternative shelter sites. Continuing the state of emergency allows us to complete this work, to partner with our partners at BPS and BDS, to modernize the shelter and temporary housing codes to ensure that they are well aligned with what we are learning about the best, most cost-effective practices in the provision of emergency shelter in terms of shelter types, locations, sizes, and programming. Thank you.
Thank you. Well done.
Oh, I appreciate it. That was my first time.
Well done. Bravo. Thank you.
As Joshua mentioned, making sure that we're transitioning folks out of shelter is really a critical part of this, which is why the city and county's shared goal of supportive housing creation is so critical. It focuses on finding permanent solutions for individuals and families who've experienced chronic homelessness and provides them with affordable quality housing and services they need to be successful in their housing and in the community. Within 1 year of operation, we already have brought on 162 new units of supportive housing and have more than a quarter of our goal in progress or plans. We also are bringing innovative solutions to our work with new funding from the state, county, and city to create low-cost innovative models, including 78 new units we recently announced and two new developments with Do Good Multnomah and Central City Concern. That brings us actually to the portion of the presentation for Rebecca.
Rebecca Esau, BDS Director. The zoning code has several types of review procedures and assigns projects to those procedures. Not to get too much in the weeds, but one of the features of the housing emergency ordinance allows the use of a faster review procedure, a type 2X instead of a type 3 procedure. The difference in those procedures is that the 2X still allows for public comment, but it skips the steps and time involved with a mandatory public hearing for a design review. Instead, it's a staff-level decision, so it can be done much more quickly. An example where we used this faster review procedure was the Gateway Park project in the Gateway District. This helped expedite the production of 75 units, 40 of which were affordable units.
The declaration of emergency has also allowed us to site two day storage units that provide secure dry storage facilities for folks' personal belongings during the daytime. One of those facilities is located under the steel bridge and has space for 60 users to store their belongings, as well as 24/7 restroom access and safe disposal of biohazards. The other day storage unit is currently located within Hazelnut Grove and is staffed by Hazelnut Grove residents.
So I think the next piece is mine. I'm Joe Zender with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So part of what we, why we're recommending the extension of the emergency is to complete our work on some code provisions that, as you have heard, will help legitimize on an ongoing basis and actually create more opportunities for the storage units, for temporary housing, and for this accelerated review process. Throughout the emergency, the life of the emergency, we've had a number of zoning code change packages that we've brought forward through City Council. We increased the number of sites and the size of possible for shelters across the city. That was a discrete package. We addressed protections for manufactured home communities. That was under the rubric or under the umbrella of the emergency. Inclusionary housing and some of the other programs to increase the housing production have been part of that. With this, we will take some of the things that we've learned and been working on with the Joint Office and with the Bureau of Development Services and make them an ongoing part of our zoning code and our programs, our tools to address the shelter issues.
So that concludes our panel of overview, and I know that you have some invited panels from a number of different providers who are working on the state of emergency.
Yes, we do. Are there any more questions for this panel before we send them back to their seats?
Mayor, I just have a
Commissioner
question.
Fish.
My agenda says that we've set aside a particular amount of time for both items 158 and 159. We've not yet read 159. Do you intend to take that up separately?
Yes. I was advised just prior to this hearing that we need to have that one read separately.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. So we do have one panel of invited guests, Rose Bach from the Catholic Charities of Oregon, Paul Susi from Transition Projects, Rich Flam from Do Good Multnomah, and Liz Weber from Join. Come on up. Thank you for being here. Appreciate your being here today.
You can start, Mayor.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners. My name is Rose Bach. I'm the Director of Housing and Homeless Services at Catholic Charities of Oregon. I'd like to take just a moment to thank you all for your commitment and the work that you have done over the years to help people who are experiencing homelessness and to serve the most needy in our community. And I appreciate you considering this resolution today. Catholic Charities of Oregon urges you to extend the state of emergency. The flexibility that it allows has been invaluable to homeless providers around the region. One of the best examples of this is our Kenton Women's Village, which you're likely familiar with. It provides safe sleeping pods with a locking door for women who have experienced long-term homelessness. Some women have been homeless for up to 10 years and do not feel safe in shelters before they come into the Kenton Women's Village. We have placed 21 of these women into permanent housing over the last 18 months or so. And I'm pleased to tell you the last three women from our original site have all been accepted into housing and will be moving into permanent housing in the next couple weeks, which will bring our number up to 24. It's very exciting. Catholic Charities really appreciates the flexibility and the innovation that the state of emergency has allowed us to try new things like Kenton. I think without innovation and without flexibility, we cannot solve this crisis. We need to be able to look at things in a new way. Due to the work that's been happening in the city and in Multnomah County, we Catholic Charities has been announced as one of five partners for a nationwide initiative through Catholic Charities USA, the Federal Reserve, and several national partners, where we will be working to repurpose church properties to create 250 units of permanent supportive housing over the next 5 years. We just announced it this morning. We're quite excited about it. And when we had our national site visit, we talked to them at length about the flexibility that we had received through the state of emergency, the work that we've done with the city and the county and the joint office and with all our homeless service providers. And they expressed to us how impressed they were with the work that we're doing in this community. And that's one of the reasons they chose to partner with this community for this exciting new initiative. As we move forward, we'll be looking forward to using some of the flexibility of the state of emergency as we create these 250 units. We will be able to use the state of emergency to accelerate the development and the repurposing of church property, the building of new buildings. It will help us as we look for new alternative models like Kenton Women's Village, and we hope to create another village in the next year or two. And most importantly, it will allow us to move people off the streets. I think we all agree even one night on the street is too much, and any flexibility that we can have to help move folks off the street, help them access services if they need it, and help them get into permanent housing is the best for us and for our community. So I thank you so much for your partnership on this and urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Soucy. I am the manager of one of the newest emergency shelters for transition projects, the Walnut Park Shelter, located on MLK and Killingsworth in Northeast Portland. We have 80 beds for men, women, and couples, and we're open every night. Prior to managing Walnut Park, I've also had the opportunity to work at almost every shelter authorized under the state of emergency. Peace 1, Columbia 1, Columbia 2, Peace 2, Fifth Avenue, Willamette Center, Y East, and now Walnut Park. Each night, I see firsthand the value of shelter services for folks struggling to regain stability, end their homelessness, and move forward with their lives. I'm therefore here today to urge that the state of emergency be extended so that our community can further strengthen our shelter services and ensure that they link up more efficiently to the one thing that truly ends someone's homelessness: housing, affordable housing. Over the past 3 years, the state of emergency has allowed transition projects to significantly expand emergency shelter options in our community. And at present, more than 700 men, women, and couples shelter with us each night across our 8 different locations. I'm immensely proud of that on a personal level and on a civic level. I'm proud of this community for doing that. The state of emergency has enabled us to pilot low-barrier shelters that welcome people as they are and thereby overcome the reluctance many folks have living on the streets that have traditionally felt about coming inside. We welcome partners, we welcome pets, we welcome possessions, and these facilities have made shelter services significantly more accessible to folks with nowhere else to turn. And yet we know that the demand for shelter still far exceeds capacity, as evidenced by the roughly 1,700 people still living unsheltered in our community each night. Under the state of emergency, Transition Projects has been able to open new shelters located across the Portland area that cater to the needs of specific populations. The Walnut Park Shelter, which I manage, which serves 80 men, women, and couples in North Portland, is an area of this city that has traditionally lacked shelter services. And I'm proud that we're attempting to redress some of the historic inequities of this city that I'm a native to, that area, that neighborhood, has experienced for generations. The Y East Shelter in East County, which serves over 100 men with priority for those over 55, veterans, and those living with disabilities, and the Willamette Center in Southeast, is the first shelter in the county specifically designed to serve single women and couples. These are all innovative facilities. All of our shelters are full every night. They're filled with people who need deeply affordable housing, and many also need wraparound support services to be successful in that housing to begin with. So along those lines, Transition Projects is proud to be working with Oregon Housing and Community Services, Metro, and the Meyer Memorial Trust to help develop LISA, the low-income single adult housing project that will bring 72 units of innovative, deeply affordable housing to the Kenton neighborhood in North Portland by the end of this year. The continuation of the state of emergency is critical to ensuring that affordable housing developments like LISA move through the system as quickly as possible, and that we are able to make progress on this community's commitment to permanent supportive housing. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Richard Flam. I am the Director of Outreach and Engagement for Do Good Multnomah. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners, and colleagues for allowing me to speak to this important issue that we're facing. In 2015, the state of emergency helped Do Good Multnomah establish the first ever veteran-specific shelter in a church in downtown Portland. We have since moved to a larger church in the Hollywood neighborhood due to the great need. That same shelter is also hosting an additional 40 people a night for the duration of the winter months. Duguid Multnomah is also operating a 50-bed winter shelter in partnership with Portsmouth Union Church in St. John's. Like transition projects, we have taken advantage of the state of emergency to expand emergency shelter capacity, but also want to see code changes that stabilize and allow us to make permanent the system shelter capacity. That's especially true as we partner with Hazelnut Grove to assist in their transition and serve as an organizational partner. We currently operate a veterans village in Clackamas County, and we know this model works. However, the codes need to be clear so that we can operate the villages appropriately. Duguid Multnomah is also embarking on a range of permanent housing projects focused on serving veterans. We have recently taken over the operations at Sandy Studios, which is 50 units of supported housing for veterans in the Hollywood neighborhood. We were also just awarded funding by the Portland Housing Bureau to develop a new affordable housing project, which includes a mixture of one-bedroom apartments and SRO units on a piece of church land that will focus on housing and supporting veterans. While we've made a lot of progress serving veterans in our community, Duguid Multnomah shelters operate with a wait list because we're full every single night. And there are more than 400 veterans in the city of Portland who we know are in need of permanent housing. The crisis for our veterans experiencing homelessness is not over. In the country they enlisted to protect, we can honor their service by ensuring they have access to basic emergency shelters and, more importantly, quality affordable housing. By defending this country, veterans have invested in creating a place that ensures basic human rights, perhaps none more important than affordable housing for themselves and for the people that they served. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate your being here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Liz Weber, and I'm the program coordinator of a multi-agency InReach housing team led by JOIN. This team was created with new funding introduced in response to the state of emergency. The InReach team brings housing placement services to people staying in two shelters, one day space, and two alternative shelter communities, Right to Dream 2 and Dignity Village. JOIN also provides on-site organizational and services support to Dignity Village. The funding that came through the state of emergency helped us meet some of the growing need that we see on the streets and in alternative shelter sites, and critically has helped to expand the reach of three culturally specific organizations, NARA, El Programa Hispano, and the Urban League of Portland. Their work with communities that are significantly overrepresented in the population experiencing homelessness is so important in addressing disparities in outcomes for these communities. Along with our other InReach partners, Catholic Charities, TPI, and the YWCA, as well as JOIN's outreach team, hundreds of people make the transition from homelessness to permanent housing each year. We know that traditional shelter doesn't work for everyone, and groups like Right to Dream 2 and Dignity Village have organized in response to the need for more safe spaces to rest at night and more options to find consistency, stability, and community. We should support the efforts of people experiencing homelessness to organize and create alternative options. At the same time, we should also provide meaningful routes to permanent housing, meaning deeply affordable and supportive housing, to the people staying in these sites. There are three gentlemen from Dignity Village who recently have had the opportunity to move into permanent housing with the help of the InReach team. Each had been living in the village for 5 years or more, and each one has significant health issues. Two use wheelchairs, and one was waiting to move into housing to schedule surgery on both his knees. All have Social Security disability income, but none were able to afford private market rent. Permanent supportive housing through other JOIN program, coupled with long-term rent assistance vouchers, provided opportunities for two of the men. The PSH retention services attached to these vouchers have meant that they're getting the support they need to improve their health, connect with community, and keep their housing. Flexible InReach funding provided a longer-term shallow subsidy for the third gentleman, who is on many subsidized housing wait lists but might not have survived the wait because his health issues are so severe and his care depends on electricity. We encourage the city to take whatever steps it can during a continued state of emergency to support the efforts of the homeless community to explore alternative shelter opportunities and to facilitate the creation of deeply affordable housing, especially supportive housing. We know that when we make the right resources available to people, they are successful in ending their homelessness. A continued state of emergency would help make those tools available. Thank you.
Mayor, I have a
thank you.
Question.
Commissioner Fish, you bet.
Thank you for an excellent panel discussion. I want to ask the gentleman from Do Good you focused on the need to provide housing for 400 veterans who continue to be homeless. Under the Obama administration, when President Obama made a commitment to end homelessness among our veterans, we had a superb tool called the VASH voucher, which allowed us to provide services and housing for our veterans. How are we doing under this administration in terms of getting VASH vouchers?
Thank you, Commissioner, for the question. I see that particularly at our permanent housing in Sandy Studios that a majority of the individuals are utilizing the HUD VASH voucher, and indeed we try to use that as much as possible in terms of supportive housing, so I do see it continuing.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I'm sorry, the gentleman next to Do Good, what was your name again?
My name is Paul Soucy.
Paul, I had a question for you. You spoke so passionately about all the shelters that you worked in, and so you probably have more expertise than most folks about what is being experienced on the ground every single day. Can you give me some sense of what's been different now that you're managing this new shelter in North Portland? How's that different than the other shelters that you've worked at?
Yes. I wouldn't necessarily ascribe this to North Portland, but what I'm experiencing, so I first started as a residential host for transition projects in the fall of 2015. I advanced from frontline staff to management, which is one reason why I'm proud of the organization that they're open to that. And I don't even have a college degree. But what I've seen since 2015 is a massive escalation in mental health crises and substance abuse issues. The emergency shelters, the low barrier shelters, are dealing with this every night. And we work with the police non-emergency line. We work with Project Respond. We work with Unity. We work with Cascadia, all of our community partners, and everybody is understaffed. Everybody is hungry for more resources, and it can be very dehumanizing for someone to experience a mental health crisis and be told, I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait 6 months, or, you know, there's just no room at Unity tonight, or, you know, what have you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Could I ask a question related to that? Because that's a provocative question, and we certainly hear, at least anecdotally, and our last point in time count, not the one we just completed where the data is still outstanding, but there was a significant increase in self-reporting of health issues, particularly mental health issues and alcohol and drug addiction. You're telling us that the resources that are available to address those issues are currently under-resourced, they are overworked. Are there other strategies that you would suggest we take in the meanwhile to help reverse this tide?
I'm afraid I don't have a comprehensive strategy to suggest. All I can continue to urge is what I tell my staff and what I tell community partners is treat people like human beings, because every story is unique and different, and everybody's challenges are multifaceted and unique to that person. And so coming up with one-size-all-fit solutions can, in my experience, has caused almost as much trauma as the original trauma itself.
Thank you.
I can certainly see why you were promoted, because, you know, I like your style. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all four of you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Carla, do we have people signed up for public testimony?
Yes, we have one person, Lightning.
Very good. Come on up. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Superhumanity. I do agree with this. I would like to have an understanding that we do not call it the state of emergency. We are the city of Portland. We are not the state. I don't see how we can declare a state of emergency. That's my opinion, and that was brought up in the past, that that would change by the governor. Moving on is that I think, as the gentleman spoke on the shelters, has been one of the most beneficial things in the city that we didn't really have before, and I think they're beginning to really refine the shelters into an experience that people actually want to go there, use the services, and then again, as stated, move up in some type of affordable permanent housing. So I do commend you on that. And again, I commend the thinking behind it to spread these shelters out, farther out, in different locations to give the people the ability to stay in maybe the neighborhoods they're homeless in. And I think that's really been effective. From my opinion on the affordable housing bond, that's been the best thing that's ever happened to this city. And as you know, with Metro combining, the dollar amounts and the resources are there to get that housing implemented. That was the key. I'd also like to follow in the footsteps of Bill and Melinda Gates. I'd like to see a $500 million initiative put together for the city of Portland to offer low-interest loans to the developers to be paid back and then continuously keep funding that out. And I'd like more research on the Bill and Melinda Gates initiative that they did in Seattle in the Puget Sound area and try to get that put into place here. Also, I want more of a focus on those 8,000 units at the baseball stadium. There's no reason why these investors can't begin to commit those units before they do their stadium, before they do anything else. I'd like to see them commit to more of the 0 to 30% units, supportive housing, start bringing in money from Seattle, other locations, and show that you're also here to take care of the homeless, even if that stadium doesn't happen. Build those 8,000 units, start now, and show the city that you really are here to take care of the people and then possibly get your stadium put into place. So again, everything is looking good. The machine is looking good. It's moving forward in a positive manner. And again, I think Portland is a place to look at and say, they're doing something right, but it's a very difficult situation. And again, just real fast, my focus is on the heroin addicts, the meth addicts, the opioid addicts, the people laying on the sidewalks. That is torture under a tarp. It is torture in my mind. We need to offer them treatment into shelters with services, into housing. It is torture in this city to allow that to take place with people who have addictions that could lead to suicide. And there's no reason to allow that anymore to happen. Get them into housing or shelters. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Any further discussion? Carla, please call the roll.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
Commissioner Udaly has amendments.
I'm sorry, I didn't get them. Okay, we have Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. As you know, I've been out for several days, as you referenced earlier. I'm scrambling to get up to speed on these items, and I just... I want to offer some amendments really for the sake of discussion. I've heard from the mayor's office that they don't feel that these are the right place to stick these
Thank
amendments,
you.
But I think they warrant conversation. So first of all, I will start by saying that 4 years ago this month, I stepped into the housing justice arena, and it changed the course of my life. I ended up here. I was also a part of a large contingent of advocates and activists, including my director of policy, Jamie Duhamel, who were called in the city in 2015 to declare a housing state of emergency. We were somewhat gratified by the recognition of that emergency, but we certainly weren't satisfied with the measures that the city took, and we're still not satisfied. And in saying that, I don't mean to dismiss the hard work that many people in this room have done. We need to acknowledge our accomplishments, but it's we obviously can't celebrate when we've got thousands of people still suffering, either on the streets, in our shelters, or under burdensome housing costs. So I appreciate the specific directives in this ordinance to make sure we're permanently changing the way we address housing and homelessness beyond the parameters of a temporary housing crisis. Myself and my office have been working pretty much nonstop on these issues since the day we arrived in City Hall. In addition to our work around tenant protections, I also co-chair the Joint Office on Homeless Services. We participate in the All In Cities Anti-Displacement Network through PolicyLink. We're currently identifying PBOT-owned right-of-ways to site more alternative shelters. And we, as a team, have invested hundreds of hours researching, discussing, and drafting policies that could help mitigate the damages of this crisis, as well as help prevent displacement from creating new crises in the future. Yet we continue to face the ever-present obstacle of a lack of funding, and that's what I want to talk about today because it's really not addressed in the existing declaration or in what we're passing today. So as an example, we spent months with community members, housing providers, and real estate representatives drafting a policy to allow tenants the opportunity to purchase rentals when owners choose to sell. This is a program that's worked really well in Washington, D.C., and has resulted in considerable investment in permanent affordable housing and home ownership opportunities for low-income households. However, without financial assistance for low-income renters to purchase and rehabilitate the properties, it would be a mostly empty gesture that would fail to benefit the people we are trying to assist.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Could you yield for 1 second?
Sure.
I was not aware that we were going to have amendments today, and perhaps my colleagues were, but there is a procedural challenge to raising amendments at this stage, which is an amendment would then be subject to public testimony in favor or against and would, in effect, reopen the hearing for that purpose. Is your intent, and I'm asking this sincerely because I was not aware that amendments were being offered, is your intent to highlight some tenant protection issues and some funding issues at the sort of beginning of our budget process to focus our attention, or is it to substantively amend this particular ordinance?
As I said at the outset, my intent is to offer these amendments for the sake of discussion. I want to have them on public record. I want everyone in the room and who's watching today to hear what I have to say. I'd like to have an opportunity to deliberate with my colleagues. I won't be disappointed if we don't ultimately advance them. But if we feel that they're worthwhile, then I don't think it would take up a lot more of our time to open it back up to public testimony, given that chambers are half full right now. So I'm going to continue with my comments. Thank you. Another example of something that we would like to see is universal eviction defense. We know through a large study done in New York that it saves money and externalized costs when cities fund lawyers for tenants facing evictions. This anti-displacement strategy is highly effective for both the tenants and for city budgets. However, as 80% of evictions are due to non-payment of rents, the program can only be successful, like it is in New York, if funds are available to help cover those gaps. On average, we could spend a few $100s to prevent an eviction instead of the thousands in services to families that we spend after they have lost their housing. When reviewing this ordinance, I noticed that there's no language around identifying ongoing revenue sources that can help solve these problems. Our office has submitted a directive to develop in this budget cycle to identify the feasibility of a vacancy tax. And so I'm just going to read the amendments into the record. And if anyone has comments or questions, I'd welcome them.
Excuse me, may I?
Commissioner Hardesty.
Are you going to move your amendments, or is this just for the public record?
For sake of discussion, yeah. So number one, Well, and I'm not even going to read them as amendments. This is what I want us to consider today and moving forward. We don't have revenue sources specifically identified to fund solutions to homelessness, displacements, and housing affordability, so many housing-related policies and programs cannot be implemented or expanded. It makes perfect sense to me that today, as we reconsider this housing state of emergency, that we'd be talking about how we're going to pay for all of these things. Funding for policies and programs such as tenant opportunity to purchase, universal eviction defense, rent subsidies, alternative shelter resources, hygiene resources, and stabilizing it and expanding the funding for the Joint Office on Homeless Services is critical to further our goals of minimizing the impacts of the housing crisis. So what I would like to see is the revenue division in coordination with PHB and others as necessary identify potential new revenue sources such as a vacancy tax, other taxes, or fees that would bring in at least $50 million annually to the city's general fund that can be specifically allocated to fund housing services and housing policies and programs and report back to council on their findings within a year. It's been suggested that I should advance these during the budget conversation, but I really didn't feel like letting this conversation go by about the housing state of emergency without raising these issues.
Mayor.
Commissioner Fish.
First of all, I want to thank our colleague who was genuinely missed this week. Although, thank you for giving us regular updates to us and to the community on your son's well-being. I appreciate that you have placed these issues before us. I had a conversation with Chair Kafoury recently where she indicated to me that she's part of some broader conversations about how to get a dedicated revenue source for the services side of supportive housing. And there is some interesting work being done in thinking about that. We have also, as a council, clearly indicated our desire to allocate a small portion of our tourist taxes to cover services. Again, a part of our strategy, which currently is unfunded. And I appreciate that you are framing these issues as issues of concern. I commit to work with you during the budget process to identify new revenue sources. One of the things I'm concerned about is, as I read the numbers, including the available one-time and ongoing resources, if we simply fund the Joint Office of Homeless Services at last year's level, we may be in a situation where we actually have no money to carve up. And that's not sustainable, even though if I had to take one last dollar that was available, I would invest it in addressing homelessness and the crisis on our streets. That's not sustainable. So building on the momentum we had, particularly with the Metro Housing Bond, and I think the appetite and willingness of coalition partners to be helpful, you know, I appreciate you flagging this issue, and I think it's something that we should sincerely address during the budget process and beyond. And so I appreciate that you have placed this in the record.
Thank you. And I'll just say I'm painfully aware that it's unlikely that we will have any money to carve up to dedicate to the kinds of additional policies and programs I'm talking about, which is why I wanted to raise the issue of a vacancy tax. As my chief of staff loves to say, we can't solve a dollar's worth of problems with a dime. And we have to start talking about other revenue sources.
I would like to chime in here, if I could, for just a minute. First of all, thank you for bringing this forward, and I concur with the sentiment that you've described. Almost coincidentally, every meeting I've had today has been about substance abuse or mental health issues, other public health issues that are clearly impacting people on the streets. We are constantly looking for resources to address the homeless crisis, which I think most people would acknowledge is the issue. It is the number one issue that we're facing right now in this city, and it's something I hear about every day. I am wondering if there is a way to compromise here to both agree to the intentions that you've put here on the record and have that seriously looked at during the budget process. And I know there was the directive to develop that was put into the record for the budget process, but it's somewhat narrower than the scope of this. So I'm wondering if there is a way we could sort of do a friendly amendment on that develop that directive to develop to include this broader sentiment. Would that be an acceptable compromise?
That's really more than I expected, Mayor, and it's very appreciated.
Could I hear from somebody from – is there somebody from the Revenue Bureau here? I thought I saw Jennifer floating around somewhere, our CFO. Well, let's why don't we do this? You'll have my personal and very public commitment that we will address this and we will look at this in the context of the budget process, and I look forward to working with you and all of our colleagues on this. And I agree with what Commissioner Fish said. I think there are multiple tables where these conversations are taking place. Let's see if we can lead them all into one cohesive conversation. But I agree with the sentiment that you put on the table there.
Thank you,
and
Mayor.
I'm appreciative of it. Please call the roll.
Fish?
Well, I think we have to begin our comments by squarely addressing the concern that Lightning has put on the table. And one of them, and Lightning is one of my favorite people who regularly participates in our deliberations because he always has something interesting to add. And he wondered why we're calling this a state of emergency when we're, after all, a lowly city. And it occurred to me that if I had my phone, I could solve this problem by just Googling the word state and come up with all the various definitions. But I think that we are all agreed that when we talk about state of emergency, we're talking about a circumstance and not a geographic boundary. We are talking about a situation that has evolved, and we're not impermissibly treading on boundaries established under the state constitution. That said, I just want to go back in time 10 years ago, which happens to be when I first joined this city council. And it's an important perspective, I think, to recall our past as we chart our path forward. There were cranes in the air 10 years ago, but the only cranes in the air that I remember were for affordable housing development, which is actually pretty extraordinary because given the collapse of the tax credit market and given all the funding challenges, it's amazing that anything got built 10 years ago. But we did not have hotels and commercial buildings and market rate residential buildings going up on every street corner. 10 years ago, we had affordable housing, maybe. And we were grateful in those days for the Obama stimulus money. And we were also grateful for an incredibly resilient community that was skilled, particularly our nonprofit partners, at weathering all the odds and getting product built. What happened is we had a recovery from the worst recession in our lifetime. And that recovery hit Portland with a vengeance. And it produced one of the great sustained periods of growth. Our economy has done wonderfully well during this time. Many of the plans that people have put in place over the last 20 years came to fruition. We started seeing jobs moving here and the unemployment rate come down to very enviable rates. But there was a price to be paid for that prosperity. And that was we ended up bidding up the price of land and market forces kicked in. And as a result, too many people found themselves unable to afford to live here. And that is what ultimately triggered a state of emergency. It was a recognition that too many of our neighbors couldn't make their rent payments, couldn't find an affordable place to call home, and that the market was in effect too robust, leaving too many people in its wake. I was very pleased that Director Callahan gave us the PowerPoint because the numbers tell an important story. The combination of the impacts of inclusionary housing, of focused and sustained investment of urban renewal resources and other resources in affordable housing development, the commitment that we made to 2,000 new units of supportive housing, the reduced barriers to siting shelters, and the renewed conversation about asking every neighborhood to come forward with a creative way to do their fair share of addressing this crisis is bearing fruit. What we've learned is that this crisis is not over and will continue for some time. Today's proposal is to extend the state of emergency for 2 years. That may or may not be enough. My guess is it won't be enough. But it is important that we give clarity to decision makers that we are going to be operating under these rules. And as Joe Zender pointed out, it's important that we bake into our code some of these changes to really get some efficiencies in how we do our development going forward. I have visited most of the West Coast cities that are dealing with the same crisis that we are dealing with. In Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles has spending literally billions of dollars to address this crisis. And yet, per capita, they have over 2 times the number of homeless individuals as we have in the city of Portland. The city of San Francisco is dealing with, on a much grander scale, this contradiction between being a city with an enormously productive economy, on the one hand, with high-tech millionaires being minted every day, and a huge problem with homelessness and a lack of affordability. The city of Seattle, which I visited recently, has a huge problem, and it seems, in my view, harsher. It seems harsher and more prevalent than the crisis that we're experiencing. Why do I say this? I say this because we are not alone. But where we are different, in my opinion, and where I have seen a difference over my service on this council, is the capacity of community partners to step up and address the problem in a collaborative way. That really is what makes Portland different. And it is what I've heard from leaders in cities up and down the West Coast, that there is a level of collaboration here and effectiveness and cohesion. It's different. So we celebrate that. And we thank today all of our nonprofit partners who are well represented in the panel for the good work they're doing. We extend this state of emergency because we continue to need to have these new tools. And as Commissioner Udaly has reminded us, this challenge that we face goes well beyond what's in this ordinance and is reflected in many other parts of our code. And there are many other opportunities for us to do more and be better and be more strategic. So, Mayor, thank you for bringing this forward. Director Callahan and all the directors who spoke earlier, thank you for your testimony to our community partners. Thank you for your inspiring stories about what you're doing in the field. And this council is fully committed to your work. And today I'm pleased to vote aye.
Hardesty?
Thank you. I also want to thank the panel and Director Shannon Callahan for an extremely important conversation and information that was shared. I want to also say that I guess I share Commissioner Udaly's concern about whether or not we're moving the goalpost. With all due respect to all the people who are working their hearts out to try to do the best they can with the limited resources that they have, the reality is even the term affordable housing is an oxymoron, because I can't tell you what's affordable for you, just like you can't tell me what's affordable for me. And we have a lot of housing that's posing as affordable housing that working people simply cannot afford to live in. And so we have to do a better job, we the city, of really being able to identify really what does an affordable housing, what does a unit that people can afford to live in look like? What does it cost? What are the services or supports that they need in order to be able to productively live in that property? And so as the newest member of this council, I know people are working their hearts out on this issue. I know that we're throwing all the resources at it that we possibly can at this moment. But I just have to tell you, I'm concerned that if at the end of the day, we still have people who work 40, 50, 60 hours a week and cannot afford to live in the city of Portland, we got a problem. And today, that's the problem that we have. Yes, are there people on the street who need mental health services? No question. Are there people that need alcohol and drug treatment? No question. But most of the people that I interact with, those are not their issues. Their issue is they're working too.